observations say about it. I'll have to go a little faster. This will be more of like a seminar style where at certain points I tell you some things that are true and I sketch how you derive them, but I don't go through all the details. There aren't going to be any, there are no more tutorials or homework problems yet. So it's okay if it's a little informal, I think. Okay. So when we left off last time, we were talking about the time-dependent harmonic oscillator in ordinary quantum mechanics with the initial condition that the frequency approaches some constant at early times and that the wave function of the oscillator is in the ground state for a constant frequency oscillator. And we explained that this problem could be solved in the Heisenberg picture by we analyzed the equations of motion for the Heisenberg picture operators and showed that I read it as a matrix. The Heisenberg picture operators were determined by a single function of time u, the mode function. Where the meaning of the Schrodinger picture operators on the right-hand side is that they are defined in the initial Hilbert space of the theory where the system is just a harmonic oscillator and it's a time-independent harmonic oscillator in its ground state. Okay. And then we showed how any expectation value you like can be computed in the terms of these mode functions. For example, the expectation value of x squared taken at time t is just u star. Now there's one other thing I want to mention that I think deserves mention, and that is one thing that came up when we were talking about this problem is that the so-called canonical commutator of the Heisenberg picture operators is equal to I. The commutator has to be taken of Heisenberg picture operators has to be taken at the same time. Let's see why that's true given our explicit solution. So if I plug in the Heisenberg picture operators and use AA dagger equals 1, then the commutator is just equal to, let's see, I have a U here commuting with a U dot star here. And then I have a U star A dagger here commuting with a U dot A here. So I get this. That is the commutator of these operators. It's really an operator on the right-hand side. I mean, this scalar function times the identity operator. It's not obvious why. Well, I forgot to say when I wrote this down that the way you compute u is that you just solve the classical equations of motion. So it looks like you're evolving the classical oscillator, but what you're really evolving is the coefficient of an operator in the Heisenberg picture solution. With a particular initial condition, which is that u of t goes to 1 over the square root of 2 omega naught, e to the minus I omega t at early times. So given that description of the mode function, why would it need to be true that this is equal to I? It's not something that's not obvious. But one thing that you can show is that the derivative of the right-hand side is equal to 0. And one way to show that is just if I evaluate the derivative, then I'll get an expression that involves second derivatives. And then if I use the classical equations of motion and substitute and everything cancels and I get zero. Or another way of thinking about it is that if you recognize this commutator as the as the determinant of this matrix, then this is what's called a Wronskian in the in differential equations. If I have two solutions to a classical differential equation, and I form a matrix with the two solutions in the columns. Here, if u is one solution to this second order differential equation, the other independent solution is u star. I form a matrix with the two solutions in the columns and then an increasing number of derivatives in the rows. Then the classical equation of motion will usually imply some caveats, but in this case implies that the derivative of this determinant is zero. Okay, so the classical equation of motion implies that this is constant. We wanted to show that it was equal to I, which that doesn't follow from the classical equation of motion because the normalization of u is not determined. But it does follow from this explicit form in the initial conditions. In fact, another way of getting the right initial conditions would be to say that I look for the solution of the classical equation of motion, which has the property that the conserved Wronskian determinant is equal to I. That's what sets the normalization. And satisfies the condition of being pure negative frequency at early times. No e to the I omega t component. Okay, so that's all I have to say. This canonical commutator is going to come back in the field theory case, so I wanted to talk about it in the quantum mechanics case. That's all I have to say about the quantum mechanics problem. Let's talk next about a field theory example. Okay, one more comment on the quantum mechanics problem. One thing that you can show that I'm not going to show is there is a nice trick for working out the Schrodinger picture wave function. I claimed that this Heisenberg picture solution is the solution of the theory and that you can compute anything you want. And in particular, there is a way of computing the Schrodinger picture wave function of sort of, we didn't solve this in the Schrodinger picture, but you can sort of reverse engineer the wave function out of the Heisenberg picture solution. It requires some tricks. I'll let you read about it in the notes, which I'll put online. Let me just comment that the answer that you get is that it turns out to be a Gaussian. Well, there's some imaginary piece here as well. So if I start in the initial state and change the frequency in an arbitrary way, then I can get a very excited state of the harmonic oscillator at a later time. But the state that I get always has the property of the wave function being Gaussian. And that is the underlying reason why the quantum mechanically generated perturbations that we see in the CMB are Gaussian, why the CMB is a Gaussian random field. Because the field values, if I square this wave function, if I were to make measurements of the particle, measure the value of x, this phase would go away. And I would just see a Gaussian probability distribution for those measurements. Similar things happens in the CMB and makes the measured CMB temperatures Gaussian. Okay, so let's graduate from quantum mechanics to quantum field theory by considering a massless scalar field. In a non-dynamical De Sitter space. So the action is just going to be with no potential term or mass term. The metric here is not being treated dynamically. So the square root of minus g and the factors of the metric hidden in these in the raising of the index here are just fixed functions of time. Of course, the case we really want to consider is the case of single field inflation, where the square root minus g is dynamical and there's a potential and an Einstein-Hilbert action. But we'll just we'll get to that next. So the De Sitter space is an FRW space with W equals minus 1, or equivalently constant H. And its metric may be written by integrating Friedmann's equation like this in proper time, which runs from minus infinity to infinity, or like this in conformal time. Where conformal time runs from minus infinity to zero. In the W equals minus one case, or more generally, I think W less than minus one third. This is a homework problem, but I forgot the answer. The conformal age of the universe is, or the total conformal time in the past is infinite, but the total conformal time in the future, or the future causal horizon, the co-moving distance spanned by the future light cone, is finite. And so it's natural to run the time coordinate from the conformal time coordinate from minus infinity to zero. And we'll use conformal time because it'll make the equation simpler. So the end of inflation is going to be at tau equals zero, and tau will generally be negative. So in conformal time, the action, if you just put in that form for the non-dynamical metric, the action will look like this. I always use dot for proper time, so I'll denote a derivative with respect to conformal time with partial tau. Or in Fourier space, like this. Oh, sorry, just 5k. Now, the advantage of going to Fourier space is that these spatial derivatives become just multiplicative factors of k. And each k mode of the field evolves independently. This action is just an integral over a bunch of independent k modes. So this looks sort of like the action for the time-dependent harmonic oscillator. In that case, we had time dependence here, but not here. In this case, we have time dependence on both terms because the 1 over h tau is sitting out in front. So it's sort of convenient, I think, for thinking about this. And you'll see in the end that this step isn't really necessary, but I like making it look like ordinary time-dependent harmonic oscillators. So canonically normalized in physics means you make whatever change of variables you need to for the kinetic term, the term with two time derivatives in the action, to have its usual 1/2 coefficient. So here if I define, if I just change variables, define the field psi to be phi over h tau, that's going to cancel this piece and just leave me with the 1/2. But I'll get some more terms from operating on the h tau with the time derivative. So let me work that out. I think maybe I'll just, because this is supposed to be like a seminar style lecture where I choose some things to not show in detail. Let me just tell you what you get. This is not totally trivial. You have to do an integration by parts. But after a small amount of algebra, you get this. The time dependence has been removed in the kinetic term, but the price I pay is that I get this weird time dependence. So in the canonically normalized field variable psi, this looks exactly like the time-dependent harmonic oscillator. Each k-mode is independent, and each k-mode behaves as a time-dependent Schrodinger harmonic oscillator with this unusual form for omega squared. That's a weird omega squared when at early times, when tau is close to minus infinity, it does look like a time-independent harmonic oscillator with omega equals k, which is the case we were considering before. But then the omega squared crosses zero and becomes negative, very negative at late times when tau is close to zero. You might worry that this is going to be, this means we have like an instability in the problem, you know, because the potential turns over. We're going to get some, in the classical case, we would get some sort of runaway behavior. But it turns out that everything is going to converge if we just integrate up to time zero. If we just ask finite time questions, stop all the evolution at tau equals zero, it turns out that there will be no divergences. All right. So now we can just write down, because we've written the action in the same form as the time-dependent harmonic oscillator we were considering before, we can just write down the solution. So in these variables, so psi k, in the Heisenberg picture, psi is an operator. So psi is now, classically psi is depends on a wave number k. And in the Heisenberg picture, each psi of k becomes a tau-dependent Heisenberg picture operator. This is just, every k is independent, so I just take the old solution and make everything depend on k. There's now a lowering operator, which is k-dependent. I have a creation operator here, and the correct sign to use is minus k. Remember, a field which is real, which is real valued in real space, upon Fourier transforming, satisfies phi of k star. Psi of k star is psi of minus k. So that means that for the Heisenberg picture operator to satisfy the same reality condition, but with the Hermitian conjugate here, you need a minus k in this operator. I would work this point out in a little more detail, but you guys have seen it in your quantum field theory class when you undoubtedly considered several examples of free quantum field theories and got mode expansions that look like this. Anyway, this is the solution where U of k satisfies the classical equation of motion. So it's just the second derivative is minus omega squared, and omega squared is this. From the analogy with the harmonic oscillator, I know that the initial conditions must be that u of kt approaches 1 over square root of 2k, e to the I omega, e to the I minus I kt, minus I k tau. So I just find the physics a little simpler to think about in the canonically normalized variable, where it really just looks like a bunch of time-dependent harmonic oscillators. Now, of course, one can now just convert the answer back to the original field variable. Phi is h tau times psi, and that same equation still holds as an equality of Heisenberg picture operators. So I can write, see, now let me, in order to make it clear which mode function I'm talking about, let me denote this mode function by u subscript psi. This u subscript psi, and I'll put the psi's here as well. Okay. So over here in on the phi side of the board, phi hat is going to be some mode function. I'll introduce the notation u sub phi. But u sub phi is just h tau as a function of, this is just a classical function, not an operator. It's h tau times u psi. Now, if I want to think about the equation of motion for u phi, I can just change variable. It satisfies the differential equation that I could obtain by changing variables in this differential equation. And of course, what I get is just the classical equation of motion for the field phi. So you can show either by direct change of variables in this differential equation, or by going back to the phi action and working out its Euler-Lagrange equation of motion, that u phi satisfies the differential equation. There's going to be an one over h tau squared, u phi. Here we tau here. And then I get k squared u of phi. All right? Yeah. Over h tau squared. Now, there's a way of writing the initial conditions. I also need to specify initial conditions. So for now, let me just specify them by converting. I'll put in the factor of h tau, and I'll say that this goes as h tau over 2k to the 1 half e to the minus ik tau at early times. Okay. The next thing I want to say is that this particular differential equation happens to be exactly solvable. So it turns out that the solution has an exact solution. The u psi is equal to the tau density. Let me write it. This is not something that is supposed to be obvious. For example, if the two here were some different number, then the solution would be a messy expression involving a Bessel function. And there's an identity that when the index of a Bessel function, j nu, is equal to 3/2, that it has, the Bessel function has some exact expression in terms of an exponential, which is what's making this look simple. Anyway, the point I want to make is just that you're not missing anything if it's not apparent how to solve this differential equation. I did check that Mathematica, if you give it this, it used to be that what you did when you got a hard differential equation like this is that you went to one of these like 1,000 page Russian books, but now that knowledge has been encoded into Mathematica. If you give Mathematica this differential equation, it spits this answer out immediately. Okay, and so over here in Fineland, the solution of this differential equation with these initial conditions is u phi is equal to h over 2 k to the 3/2 1 plus I k tau e to the minus I k tau. All right. So let's pause here to compute a fundamental result, which is the power spectrum of phi at the end of inflation. Recall that that's computed by calculating the expectation value of phi the two-point expectation value of phi in Fourier space. And we want to take the limit. We can calculate that for any tau and then take the limit as tau goes to 0. If you put in these mode functions, then you get right away the answer h squared over 2k cubed times 1 plus k squared tau squared. That's just u phi. Let me write that as two steps. It's u phi star. Just like in the harmonic oscillator case, the expectation value of x squared was the absolute square of the mode function times the expected delta function in k minus k prime. And then plugging in the explicit form of the mode function, this is h squared over 2k cubed times 1 plus k squared tau squared. And this, by definition, the prefactor of the delta function in the two-point function is the power spectrum. Recall from our discussion of the power spectrum that k cubed, oh, sorry, I want to take tau to 0, so get rid of that piece. So you recall in our discussion of power spectra that the combination k cubed p of k is taken as a measure of the dimensionless size, or rather its square root is the dimensionless size of the fluctuations. We actually defined it with a 2 pi squared. And so this is h squared over 4 pi squared. This is a very fundamental result. It says that the in this model, the massless field in De Sitter at a non-dynamical De Sitter space, perturbations are quantum mechanically generated, and their characteristic size is of order h of the Hubble constant of the De Sitter space time. There's one more thing to say about this. So I like working out this phi action based on this detour of going through the canonically normalized field psi, just so you can see how it's really the same thing as the time-dependent harmonic oscillator, which is very intuitive. But really, all we got out of that detour, we could have written, if we had not done the detour, I think it would have been easy to write down this. But not so easy to see what initial conditions to use for the mode function. Those were pretty transparent in the canonically normalized case when we could just read them off based on our understanding of the harmonic oscillator. But otherwise, it would be kind of, you know, maybe not so clear why there's this h tau here, why this particular form. So I propose the following method for any field variable, whether it's canonically normalized or not. You can always get the correct normalization for the mode function or the correct initial conditions by using the requirement that the canonical commutator be equal to zero, that the commutator of phi with its conjugate momentum be equal to zero. In this example, the conjugate momentum is the conjugate momentum to phi. You just differentiate the action with respect to phi dot to get the conjugate momentum. It's phi hat 1 over h tau squared phi hat dot. And this will give you the condition that with the 1 over h tau squared in front, that u dot star, these are u phi's, minus u phi star u phi dot, must be equal to I. If you remember that, if you compute that quantum mechanical normalization and remember that the exponential is supposed to be an e to the minus I k tau, then you always get the right normalization. So if you're a high-powered quantum field theorist, you don't need to go through the detour of the canonical normalization. You just write this down and say that it is the solution to the theory, where the mode function's where the mode function is negative frequency at early times and satisfies this canonical commutator normalization for all times. All right. Now, I want to talk about the massless scalar field in a non-dynamical, this is almost the same as the De Sitter space, a non-dynamical FRW background. The case I'll be interested in is the case where the background is slow roll, in other words, close to De Sitter. But most of the equations will apply for an arbitrary A of t. So this is very similar to the De Sitter case. So I'll just go through it quickly. So the action in the phi variable is this. And the solution is that the Heisenberg picture operator phi hat is some mode function times an annihilation operator plus the Hermitian conjugate. Where? The differential equation satisfied by the mode function is just the same as the equation of the classical equation of motion of the field phi. So there's an a squared here. And an a squared, k squared a squared on the right hand side. And the normalization squared u phi equals, that's the canonical commutator for this field theory. You can also show that at early times the correct initial conditions to use are this should go as A. So the A should be downstairs. And the power spectrum at the end of inflation is just, actually this equation would be true at all values of tau, is just given by squaring the mode function. If the FRW background is something more complicated than De Sitter, like a slow roll potential, then you'll no longer be able to solve this classical equation of motion analytically. But everything that you need to put it on the computer is here, and this is often what's done. You have some initial conditions, you have an equation of motion, and you can evolve everything forward and compute the power spectrum of the field phi at the end of inflation. Now there's an approximation which is really useful, which is that if the background is slow roll, then the power spectrum of phi is just given by the same power spectrum as in the De Sitter case, h squared over 2k cubed, but with some caveats. First off, there's a plus dot dot dot, where plus dot 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 means dot 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 means plus higher order in the slow roll expansion. term suppressed by powers of the several parameters epsilon and eta. And the star means in the de Sitter case, h was constant. But in the slow roll case, h will be a slowly varying function of conformal time. So the star means evaluated at horizon crossing, which means the time when k is equal to ah. So there's some wave number where you're computing the power spectrum. If I had more time, I would tell you how this is derived and what physics is lurking behind this statement. Since we only have 20 minutes left, I'll just say in words that one over ah is a quantity with dimensions of length. And that is a very important quantity in inflation because it's the co-moving distance traveled by a light ray per factor of E, per Hubble time. That's the right way to say it. The co-moving distance traveled by a light ray per Hubble time. And the co-moving horizon. And it is a very rapidly decreasing function during inflation. It's an exponentially decreasing function of proper time. At early times, at a fixed value of k, the wavelength of the mode will be much smaller than the co-moving horizon. And the mode function behaves the same way as a mode function in a non-expanding Minkowski universe. Intuitively, when the wavelength of a mode is much smaller than the causal length scale of inflation, the mode doesn't feel the expansion of the universe, and it thinks it's just a mode living in a Minkowski space. At late times, this length scale is much less than the wavelength of the mode, and the mode is frozen in by causality. So the differential equation for the mode at late times is just phi dot equals zero. And that's because if I have a very long wavelength mode, the equations of motion want to make that mode oscillate and remove the fluctuation. But if the causal horizon is much smaller than the wavelength of the mode, causality prohibits this part of the mode from talking to this part of the mode to know that there's an oscillation to equalize. So the mode gets frozen. The transition between these regimes happens at horizon crossing, at the time in inflation when the co-moving horizon is of the same order of magnitude as the wavelength of the mode. And it's the Hubble parameter at that time that sets the power spectrum at the wave number k. Okay, so those are a bunch of statements I couldn't quite justify. Now, let's talk about single field slow roll inflation. So we showed, spent an order one fraction of the class showing that single field slow roll inflation looks like this. We understand what the, I'm writing out the action in conformal time. Okay. We know that the dynamical degrees of freedom in single field slow roll inflation are a scalar mode zeta and a gravity wave or spin two mode gamma with two polarizations. Let's analyze their actions. So this action is exactly the same as the case we just considered. Each mode, each polarization of gamma behaves as a massless field on a non-dynamical FRW spacetime. That's something that's not obvious because the underlying action that was the starting point of deriving this had a fully dynamical metric, but that's what you get after a long calculation. The only difference is that the prefactor is different. There's an M Planck squared over 8. So if you put that in, then I leave it for you to show that the power spectrum, we can read off, except for this normalization. So the normalizing prefactor affects the power spectrum because the canonical commutation relation looks like this, where p gamma is the derivative of the action with respect to gamma dot. And so the overall normalization of the action goes into setting the canonical commutator normalization. When you put that in, then a short calculation shows that the power spectrum of the gravity waves looks like this. So there's that same M Planck squared over 8. We're writing this a different way. There is, by the way, a factor of 2 here that's just actually a matter of purely a matter of convention. We're writing this a different way. Delta, the dimensionless power spectrum, looks like this, h squared star. If this were a constant in k, then we would have predicted that the power spectrum of the gravity waves is scale invariant. It's not quite scale invariant because during single field Searle inflation, h squared is a slowly varying function of conformal time. And so the star, here means evaluated at k equals ah. And so because every time I, if I increase k, then I'm slightly increasing the time when I evaluate h squared. And that slightly changes the value. And so I have some, what I'm really predicting here is a weak scale dependence. If you work this out, in the slow roll approximation, you can show, so if I want to quantify that scale dependence, I might compute this. Which has a name, it's called the tensor spectral index. This turns out to be minus 2 epsilon. In slow roll inflation, you can remember in the slow roll approximation, you can compute any quantity in sight, in particular, this particular time derivative of h squared, which arises in terms of local quantities. I'm trying to write everything in terms of h squared and the slow roll parameters epsilon and eta. Let's talk about the scalars. In the scalar sector, things look different. I don't have the a squared here anymore. I have this function. But all that means is that I can view the scalar action as a non-dynamical massless field on a fake expansion history, on an FRW background with a fake expansion history. In other words, if I just define this function that appears here to be a prime of tau, then I now have two expansion histories. There's the real A of tau, and then there's this fake expansion history A prime of tau. And I can get I can read off the power spectrum of the scalars by just applying this formula to the fake expansion history. Since I only have about 10 minutes left, that's a straightforward prescription. I'll just tell you what you get when you do this. You get this. And the associated tilt, which is defined to be, there's this unfortunate historical convention that the tensor spectral index is defined to be the derivative of log delta with respect to log k, but in the scalar spectral index is defined with this extra plus one or extra minus one. So ns equals one would correspond to the scale invariant case. Then medium length calculation involving slow roll ology gives this. And so what I have on the board, sometimes these equations are summarized in a different way. So if I have a function of k, which is it's a slowly varying function of k, and I know its spectral index, then I can choose to approximate it by a power law. This is the equation you'll find in the books. This is just the power law spectrum that has the same value at some reference wave number k star and the same spectral index at the reference wave number. Corrections to this power law form turn out to be second order and slow roll parameters and are negligible given the current error bars. And so our prediction from inflation is that the power spectrum of zeta should have this power law form with a coefficient given by this expression and an exponent given by this expression. And for the tensors, similarly, with these numbers appearing. Okay, I've almost finished at the end of my notes. So those are the predictions of single field slow roll inflation. Let's just assume for a moment that you are so convinced by the beauty of this theory that you believe that single field slow roll inflation is the correct physics of the early universe. Let's compare with the observations and see what they have to say. So you might wonder first how we understand at the end of inflation there's the scalar mode zeta, which has is a Gaussian random field with a certain power spectrum, and there are Gaussian random gravity waves with a certain power spectrum. It is true, you might wonder how I'm going to link those up to the CMB. So there's a general theorem that says, so one thing that has to happen is the inflaton has to decay, the inflaton particle has to decay into standard model particles so that the inflaton dominated part of the expansion history can turn into the radiation dominated hot Big Bang. And there's a theorem that says that the fluctuations in these fields, zeta and gamma, go into well-defined fluctuation modes of the fields during the hot Big Bang, fluctuations in the photon density, dark matter density, and so on. That mode is called the adiabatic mode. So I'm just going to assume as a given that if I can predict zeta and gamma at the end of inflation, I predict a certain set of initial conditions for the CMB, namely the Gaussian adiabatic initial conditions. And these are observed to incredibly high precision, like one part in 1,000. So that's a very non-trivial success of this theory. back in the day, 30 years ago, there were other theories that say that maybe the initial fluctuations in our universe were created by cosmic string defects. Those models predict very non-Gaussian, or by the standards of modern data, very non-Gaussian initial statistics, and a very different type of mode than the adiabatic mode. Initial conditions are so different that in those models, you don't even see like acoustic peaks in the CMB. They're smeared out. So this was a very important and striking initial success of inflation. Nowadays, going beyond that, let's start by talking about what is constrained, ordered from the best constrained quantities to the least constrained. So this quantity, delta zeta, is constrained incredibly well by the CMB. So this is current data constrained to a few percent. So if single field inflation is the truth, then there is this particular combination of parameters, h squared over the slow roll parameter epsilon, that's incredibly well constrained. Unfortunately, this is a little hard to interpret on its own. You can write h squared to leading order in slow roll is v, and epsilon is v prime squared over v squared. So this is some prefactor times v cubed over v prime squared. So for what it's worth, we know this particular derivative combination very accurately. Next up is the scalar spectral index, which doesn't involve any h's, but just these slow roll parameters. Remember that epsilon is, in Planck units, v prime over v squared, and eta is v double prime over v. So epsilon, the spectral index, or rather ns minus 1, gets contributions from first and second derivatives of the potential. And this is now known to be non-zero at high statistical significance. I mean, it's measured to sort of, one part and measured at like the 10% level. This has the order of magnitude and sign expected for simple models of inflation like m squared phi squared. This is another way to say it is that when you observe this parameter being non-zero, you started to see the evolution of the potential down the hill. You see the deviations from scale invariance or the deviation from the de Sitter expansion. Or another way of thinking about it is that you see the non-zero derivatives of the potential. But you don't know how much of this number comes from the v prime and how much of it comes from the v double prime. So cosmological gravity waves are detectable in the CMB if the inflationary model generates them. And the gravity wave amplitude is usually quoted as a tensor to scalar ratio in the power spectrum or the ratio of the deltas, which is 16 epsilon, using the formulas on the other board. And here we don't have a measurement, we just have an upper limit. So this is known to be less than 0.12 at 95% confidence level. This upper limit will get much better soon. I guess that in the next 5 years, this will be somewhere between 10 to the minus 4 and 10 to the minus 3. So the upper limit is already enough to disfavor simple models like m squared phi squared. That's disfavored at something like 95% or 98% confidence. I forget the exact number. And it favors models of inflation that start to flatten the potential out, or that increase more slowly than m squared phi squared. That's easy to see because if I want to make r small, and fix the value of ns minus 1, then all of the ns minus 1 has to be coming from the eta. I'm trying to make epsilon small. So all the ns minus 1 has to be coming from the eta. That is, I'm trying to make the first derivative small and keep the second derivative, which happens if I start inflation at the top of a hill. At the top of a hill, the first derivative is 0, but the second derivative is non-zero. So models, these so-called hilltop models, correspond to models with undetectable R. Imagine R getting pushed down to 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 4. Then you get really pushed into this hilltop territory. So sometimes those models are said to be fine-tuned, that the small r case is fine-tuned. Because, let me put a question mark. Because, you know, it looks like some tuning was required to start the inflaton at the top of a hill, and for our observable C and B to have crossed modes, to have crossed the horizon near the starting point. So there's another way to interpret R, which is the energy scale of inflation. Imagine that we do measure R. Now we have three numbers. So there's the predictions of single field inflation depend on H, epsilon, and eta. That's three numbers. And right now we have two measurements and just an upper limit for the third number. Once we measure this number, everything will be pinned down. We'll have measured three numbers in a three-parameter space, and we'll know H squared, we'll know epsilon. So H squared translates to a measurement of V. Once that's pinned down, measuring epsilon will translate to a measurement of V prime. Once eta is pinned down, it'll translate to a measurement of V double prime. We'll have measured the potential in its first two derivatives. So a measurement of R would determine epsilon. And given that H squared over epsilon is super well measured, that could be translated to a measurement of H, which is the energy scale of inflation. So another way if we want to quote the energy scale of inflation as a number with dimensions of energy, then we can take the energy scale of inflation to the 1/4 power. The energy scale of inflation by Friedman's equation is this. And then if I assume that H squared over epsilon is measured perfectly, so that I want to translate a measurement of epsilon to a measurement of the energy scale of inflation, when I put in all the numbers, I get this. R to the 1/4 times 3.2 times 10 to the 16 GeV. So from this way of thinking about it, though the exponent here is really shallow, whether R is observed to be 10 to the minus 4 or 10 to the minus 3 or 0.1, maybe it's right on the edge of the current upper limit, the energy scale of inflation turns out to be about the same number, some number on the order of a few times 10 to the 16 GeV, some number around the gut scale. So another way of thinking about models with detectable gravity waves is that the gravity waves are telling you the energy scale of inflation, and if they're detected, then the energy scale of inflation has to be right around this exact value, right around the gut scale. Now, for all we know, the energy scale of inflation could be anywhere. We've measured physics up to the TeV scale, and we know, well, so our current upper limit on R translates to an upper limit that's around the gut scale, but it could be anywhere in between. So if we think about the energy scale of inflation as being this sort of unknown parameter here, then we would say that large R is the, or detectable R, is the fine-tuned case. I mean, if we just are being agnostic, we have no idea what the physics is. Could be anywhere between the electroweak scale and the gut scale. Well, what are the odds that it would be right at the gut scale? Different physicists argue back and forth based on fine-tuning arguments whether we should expect to not find R and that seeing it would be the fine-tuned case, or vice versa. I guess the good news is that we'll make the measurement soon and find out who's right. If we do measure R, and we're in this situation where epsilon is pinned down and we have the three numbers in a three-parameter space, then there's one more future observation we can try to make that would be a really fantastic vindication of inflation, which is that we computed NT, but we didn't really talk about it. If R is detected, if the gravity waves are detected, then there's the possibility of trying to measure the spectral index of the gravity waves, which is then no longer a free parameter. It's predicted by the theory. NT, because NT is minus 2 epsilon and R is 16 epsilon, NT is always predicted to be minus R over 8. So if we see gravity waves, we measure R, then the next thing that we can try to do is measure their spectral index. And if we find that this equation holds, this is sometimes called the single field consistency relation. Then that would be an incredible prediction of this simple model to verify. And I think most people would be convinced that it's the correct model. I am 5 or 10 minutes over time. There is a lot more to say. In fact, I could keep talking about the early universe for at least 5 or 10 more weeks. This particular model, single field slow roll inflation, is one of many inflationary models. And going beyond inflation, there are other models of the early universe that rely on completely different physics that can explain the observed fluctuations. What they all have in common is infinite conformal age and quantum mechanical generation of perturbations. But that's the end of the class, so I'll have to stop here. Thanks. Thank you.